You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome to a very special bonus episode of the 12 of Hell Radio Show. I'm Joe Thrashenkill, and with me today, it's just me. You will not hear the voices of Breno or Jordan. They're off. They're resting. So I was inspired to do my first, and I'm pretty sure this is my first solo episode of the Toilet Podcast by a number of reasons. Number one, you know, my boys are going through some things and they couldn't record, which means that they're also not here to tell me maybe this episode isn't such a great idea. Number two, you know, I've always wanted to do a show dissecting what's honestly my favorite book. Not just about music, but, you know, just anything in general. I don't really like reading fiction. I read nonfiction almost exclusively. And about 50% of the nonfiction that I read is about music. I have a lot of books about music. Most of them they're fucking trash, man. Like, it's total hagiographic garbage. You know, I still read them, but, you know, they're bad. And this one's different. I realize that this year actually marks the 20th anniversary of its release, and I wanted to revisit and see how the book holds up. I first read it in I think it was 2006. I was in college, and I just found the book just really inspirational. It made me want to play music. It made me want to write about music. I was doing both of those things, but I was not. It gave me the spark that I needed, I guess. And this is actually my third copy of the book. The other two got borrowed by friends after I was raving about it, and they never returned it. So I don't blame them. It's good. And then I guess finally what really made me want to do this is that we had that bad winter storm here in Texas, and it was pretty fucking bleak, if we're being honest here. My house didn't have power for a few days, and then, you know, we didn't have water. So me and my wife and all of our animals, the chickens, the dogs, the cats, we drove very slowly down the street to my best friend's house. They didn't have power either, but they did have water, so that sounded pretty good. So we stayed with them, I think, for 4 days, and eventually we lost water there too, unfortunately. So it was kind of rough. But then one morning, the power came back on, and, you know, I could hardly believe it. It was absolutely luxurious. So we made coffee, and my friend put on the stereo. We were listening to the entire discography of The Replacements, and that's a band I learned about from this book. And that became like a thing I shared with all my friends, a band that, you know, just has some great memories for all of us. And it was just such a great feeling, just a wave of comfort and gratitude. And this book, you know, it played a strong part in keeping the memory of that band, The Replacements, alive. You know, it introduced it to a new generation of people that weren't around for the first time, and, you know, they also found something to love with it. So this is it. This episode is about a book called Our Band Could Be Your Life. This book was written by Michael Azarad over a period of 3 years, back before the internet was really useful for research. So Michael spent years reading whatever books he could find, tracking down fanzines, talking to people that were around, doing, you know, on-the-ground research for this whole thing. This is a book exclusively about what was going on in the 80s with the American underground scene, so I apologize for the U.S.-centric nature of this episode. You know, it kind of is what it is. And I've done something a little bit different this month, too, with the Toilet of Hell mixtape. To correspond with this episode, I've picked some of my favorite tunes from these bands featured in the book to be the soundtrack. There are 13 bands featured in detail in Our Band Could Be Your Life. There is Black Flag, The Minutemen, Mission of Burma, Minor Threat, Husker Du, The Replacements, Sonic Youth, Butthole Surfers, Big Black, Dinosaur Jr., Fugazi, Mudhoney, and Beat Happening. And I'm going to play something from all of them, except for Beat Happening. And that's because Beat Happening fucking sucks. I can't abide by it. So you're going to get a couple of tracks from a different band. But, you know, feel free to investigate Beat Happening if you're curious. But I just really cannot get into it. I doubt you will either, but, you know, I can't speak for you. Your mileage may vary. This book came out in 2001, and it covers the, quote, American indie underground from 1981 to 1991. 81 is notable for many reasons, but I would say possibly most notably, it was the year that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated and the U.S. began its long, long decline. In 1991, the other book ended this, as many writers have penned, it was, quote, the year that punk broke, you know, into the mainstream, as it were. So suddenly, that's when you had Nirvana blowing up. You had Green Day selling, you know, quintuple platinum records. And incidentally, a Hot Topic probably opened up in a mall near you. So this is a book that covers hardcore, industrial, grunge, punk, noise rock, art rock, straight rock and roll, in some cases, and in the cases of Beat Happening, this god-awful twee music that would kind of become the template for what the early to mid-2000s alternative scene was, at least in my eyes. There is a notable lack of straight heavy metal in this book, you know, and at well over 500 pages, for just 13 bands, it is perhaps understandable that Azerrad didn't want to tack on an additional, you know, 7,000 pages to cover American metal in the 80s. You know, anecdotally, I've heard people tell me that metal just did not mix with other genres in this time period. You know, you could be a metal guy or you could be something else, but you could not be both. You know, there were exceptions to this. James Hetfield was reportedly a big Black Flag fan, and Black Flag, you know, they were really into Dio during their long hair phase. And it wouldn't be long until, you know, everything was taking inspiration from everything else. You know, the bands in this book made their influence in the world of metal years later, and non-metal bands, they learned about bullet belts. You know, it's in the decades since, it's a big pot of chili. But I'd like to, you know, add a little context here anyway, just to create a clear timeline of when we're talking about. So Metallica, Anthrax, and Slayer, they all started in 1981, the period that this book begins with. In 1982, Megaforce Records was founded. And, you know, fun story, Megaforce, they had a ton of metal bands, but they also had the Meat Puppets as a band that is mentioned a lot in this book as well. In addition to Megaforce, you had Metal Blade, which was founded in 82, and Combat Records was founded in 83. Combat put out stuff from Dark Angel, Nuclear Assault, and Death, and Metal Blade, I don't think you need an introduction to Metal Blade. Megaforce would, of course, release Metallica's first two albums before they signed to a major with Elektra in 1986. So it's a little bit more difficult to piece together because at this time things were a little bit more fractured regionally. You had bands all over the country putting out stuff on tiny labels hoping that they might get scooped up by Metal Blade. And over in Europe you had even more going on. I have yet to find a book on metal that really dives into the smaller scenes in America going on like it does in Our Band Could Be Your Life. But if you know of one, you know, let me know, or hopefully one of you guys is writing it. So just a fun fact I'd like to add in here. There is an audiobook version of Our Band Could Be Your Life that came out in 2019. And you want to know who narrated the Big Black portion of the book? That's right. None other than Corey Taylor, the Stone Sour Man. So I guess one other thing is it's also a little bit different because metal was pretty big in the 80s, and the style that most of these bands play was, you know, decidedly not. You had a shit ton of bands, metal bands that were not necessarily interested in DIYing. Everyone knows that, you know, Slayer toured in the Camaro with a U-Haul attached to the back, but you also had a lot of bands that they just really wanted to be rich and famous. If there is a spirit to this book, it's that you can do everything you need to do on your own. And there is a huge difference that I have to note from when the book was released and now. And that is that it is no longer possible to support yourself playing music. These bands played shows and they sold physical records. You can play a show, but that physical element just isn't there anymore. At least not in the volume that is necessary to make money. Now, I know we harp on that all the time, but I hope a new wave of bands is figuring out how to get fucking paid, because I don't see how it's done now. But I have done way too much preamble here without even getting to the book. Let's go ahead and start this first section. This might not be the most fun part of the book. The book is pretty fun overall, but it is essential. This is the Rosetta Stone for DIY music in America. And in no small way, one of the biggest influences on extreme music from their time to right now. I am talking, of course, about Black Flag. Do you ever look at the vibes around a band or a scene and think, God damn, this is toxic, and it's not fun, and everyone's miserable? There's a pretty good chance that Black Flag is responsible for that. But Black Flag is also responsible for setting up the nationwide distribution and touring networks that made underground music viable in America. The product of Greg Ginn, a ham radio dork from Hermosa Beach that hated rock and roll, but did love the Grateful Dead, Black Flag was the linchpin on which, you know, this whole thing kind of rests. Ginn started SST, standing for Solid State Tuners, as a mail order business that sold surplus radio equipment. And that would eventually evolve into SST Records, which hosted everyone from the Minutemen to Husker Du to Sonic Youth to Dinosaur Jr. and, of course, Black Flag and many, many others. Ginn set up Spot in Hermosa Beach with his family when he was a kid, and earlier on, when he started playing a little bit of music, he met a fella known as Spot who wrote record reviews for a Hermosa Beach paper. Ginn would sometimes stop by the vegetarian restaurant where Spot worked and shoot the breeze about music. He was a nerd, Spot recalls. He was just an awkward nerd who was very opinionated, and I couldn't imagine him ever being in a band. Later, Spot would become an assistant engineer at a local studio, which had cheap hourly rates and 16-track recording. So when Ginn asked him to record his band, Spot agreed, figuring it would be a nice break from the usual, you know, folk music he was recording. They only had 6 songs, Spot recalls, and they could play their entire set in 10 minutes. This would be a fruitful relationship between the two. Spot would go on to be the in-house producer for almost all SST records, and a major reason why these records sound so shitty nowadays. So with his band Panic, Greg Ginn was wanting to, you know, cut a record. There was a local record label called Bomp Records that mostly did garage pop style revival stuff, but they didn't want anything to do with it. So, you know, he figured, I had enough experience, you know, making SST electronics. You know, I have a degree in economics from UCLA. I bet I can do this shit myself. Ginn said that he just looked at the phone book under record pressing plants and found that there was only one, so he took it into him. You know, I figured we could just do a sleeve and fold it in a plastic bag. So then we got singles made and put it in there, and it worked out. And Ginn got his brother, who went by the name of Raymond Pettibon, to do the cover. Raymond Pettibon, of course, massively influential artists throughout the 80s, and you can recognize his artwork on all of the Black Flag releases. So Pettibon suggested the name. The band changed their name from Panic to Black Flag because there was already a Panic at the time. So they did it. And in the very beginning of 1979, they put out the Nervous Breakdown EP. It is a four-track hardcore record that was different from everything else at the time. It wasn't punk. It was hardcore. It was meaner. It was uglier. It was a new thing. And it took time for this to get around, but when it did, people lost their fucking minds. And this started to attract the kind of like, surfer dudes in Hermosa Beach. There was a new kind of punk, and the cops were confused. All of a sudden, you're dealing with thick-necked guys who were drunk and could go toe-to-toe with some cops, and guys will get in a cop's face, said Henry Rollins. I mean, they're white. They're from Huntington Beach, so you can't just shoot them because they're not black or Hispanic, so you have to deal with them on a semi-human level. The sheer force of the numbers it shows totally freaked the cops out to where they, just said, don't try to understand it, we'll just squelch it. Well, how do they squelch it? Well, they just smash the hell out of them, arrest them for no reason, smack them on the head, intimidate the shit out of them, and boy, was it insane. And that is kind of the hallmark of the early days of Black Flag, where cops and Black Flag did not get along. They eventually got banned from every venue in L.A. So if the band wanted to keep playing, they had to get out of town. And back then, only a handful of, underground bands did national tours. Lower-tier major label bands did them as, promotional loss leaders. And independent label bands couldn't afford to have a loss leader. Besides, there's New York, LA, and Chicago that had punk venues, and nobody else had that. So, the solution was to tour as cheaply as possible and play anywhere they could. Going from elk hall lodges to somebody's living room. They didn't demand a guarantee or accommodations or any of the prerequisites for touring. They figured out they could live rough as fuck and survive and make this happen. And, well, that's exactly what they did. All of the description of the entirety of Black Flag's touring, it's rough. Everything is maybe digging through a trash can to find a sandwich, stealing and scamming as much as you can along the way to try to get enough gas to get on the road in what is surely the worst vehicle of all time. The band went through a series of members. Notably, by the time they got to the most iconic member of the group, one Henry Rollins, they had gone through three singers. Henry Rollins, all the way over in D.C., got a copy of the Nervous Breakdown EP, fell in love with it, and started corresponding with Chuck Dukowski, the charismatic bass player of the band, who kind of did all of the face work that Greg Ginn was simply not capable of doing. He got an offer to join the band as a singer, with his experience singing in SOA in D.C. at the time, and he jumped on it. He quit his job at the ice cream shop he was working at and got a bus ticket across the country, immediately went on a full tour with them. By this time, we're in 1982. They're on tour in Tulsa when a grand total of two people showed up. Henry Rollins, brand new to the group, is pretty disappointed by this, but the bass player straightens him out. He tells him that there's only two people there, but they came there to see Black Flag, so you better put on a fucking Black Flag show for them. And, that's what they did. And that's kind of how the band made things happen for themselves. They would do shows that nobody else would do in places nobody else would play them, living under circumstances that nobody would want to ever live in, to play their guts out for two people who then told everybody that they knew that this was the most important band in the world. So by this time, Black Flag is recording a couple of records, and SST is selling them to small distributors for deliberately low prices. But because, the distributors usually sold import records, their releases wound up in specialty shops. Stuck in the import section for, high dollar prices, even though they weren't imports. They were, an American band. because they were, you know, on an independent label, they couldn't get into the rock section of a normal record store. So Black Flag, you know, pretty fed up with this, decided to find a mainstream distributor. So most of them wouldn't return their phone calls, but one did. That was MCA. So as a part of that deal with MCA, Genn agreed to co-release the album with Unicorn, which is a small label distributed by MCA. But in 82, just as it was about to go out to the stores, someone from Rolling Stone allegedly badmouthed Black Flag to MCA distributor chief Al Bergamo, who abruptly announced that it would be immoral to release Damaged, claiming the album was, quote, anti-parent, past the point of good taste. It certainly wasn't like Bob Dylan or Simon and Garfunkel and the things they were trying to say, he added. So because they claimed that for their offensive content, that, you know, the band, you know, they weren't going to sell it, but, you know, they went ahead and released it anyway, just putting stickers over the MCA label on all of these records. They put out 20,000 of these things. That may have been a red herring, the anti-parent message in this record, because others inside claimed that Unicorn was so deeply in debt to MCA that it just made no sense for MCA to continue their relationship. So it was just an excuse to sever ties with Unicorn. But the band put these out, and then they filed a bunch of lawsuits because they claimed that Unicorn didn't pay SST rightful royalties and expenses for the album. Unicorn countersued and got an injunction preventing them from releasing any further recordings until it was settled. So when SST issued the retrospective of unreleased Black Flag material called Everything Went Black with no band credit on it, Unicorn hauled SST into court in July of 83 and painted the band as some kind of threat to society. The judge found that Greg Genn and Dukowski, as the co-owners of SST, had violated the injunction and sent them both to LA County Jail for 5 days for contempt of court. Now, this is pretty interesting and indicative of the character of Greg Genn here. Upon his release, Genn was stoic. He would not even discuss it, Roland said. He was just, practices at seven. He didn't discuss it. I'm not kidding, not a word. He didn't have any idea what it was like for Greg Genn in jail. He said nothing, except he got on the bus to go to county. He had a sandwich in his front pocket, and a guy reached over the seat and just took his sandwich. So Greg wouldn't say anything about the experience at all, other than saying, it's not something I would recommend. It's a very demeaning thing, and I'd recommend to anybody that they try to stay out of there. Finally, Unicorn went bankrupt in late 83, and Black Flag could finally release records again. At this point, the band is a touring and recording machine. They are unstoppable. They take their first trip over to Europe, where their reputation has preceded them, and everybody wants to fight them, to throw piss at them, to spit on them. It generally seems like a very bad time, especially in Germany, as they're fighting skinheads. When they pulled up to a club in Italy, there was a crowd of mean-looking punks waiting for them. They circled the van, started rocking it and pounding the windows, and the band was getting scared, trying to figure out how to get into the club without, you know, getting the shit beaten out of them, you know. So finally they get out of the van, they make a run for it, and the mob surrounds them and begins hugging and kissing them and giving presents to them, which is, to this point in my career, the nicest thing I've ever heard about Italians, especially Italian punks. You know, eventually the co-founder, Chuck Dukowski, and Greg Genn are having a tough time. Greg Genn is a harsh taskmaster. He is a personally unlikable man, and being stuck with this guy, you know, your entire day, every day, apparently took its toll. So, you know, Dukowski went ahead and exited the band right before the release of My War. But he went on to become the band's manager and the head of the booking arm, Global Booking. And that was really, that was necessary because every band on the label just did relentless touring, and you know, Dukowski was responsible for getting these guys in every venue across the country. Now, I mentioned this before, the poverty that the band kind of endured, and I thought that this would be a relevant anecdote from the book here. So on the road, the band got $5 a day. Towards the end of the band, they made $10, and on the very last tour, they made $20 a day. If they got a flat tire, they would find an old tire that was discarded in the back of a gas station, and they just put it on the van, and that was it. It is tough times in the Black Flag camp, even though they're winning over audiences, touring their asses off, and generally making punks across the world happy and angry. In 85, they release Loose Nut, which is probably my favorite record of theirs. It's stupid. It's stupid, misogynistic hard rock. But this was really marking the end of the band. Raymond Pettibon never got paid for any of the artwork he was doing for this band. He did a lot of it for him. And he was getting frustrated that he was essentially known as the Black Flag guy. So the final straw came with the cover for Loose Nut. And at that time, you know, they had been doing this so long, everybody was becoming such a force of personality. Genn is Greg Genn, a cruel taskmaster, mean to everybody around him. And Henry Rollins had become the most angsty person alive, incapable of dealing with anyone. You know, really trying to make his own life more miserable than it had to be. And, you know, by 86, bands were starting to make it that it came from the same scene. And everybody in Black Flag was so goddamn miserable with each other, by their own making, really, that they decided that, you know, this is it. It's time to retire Black Flag. But fortunately, SST soldiered on with our second band here, the Minutemen. Let's go ahead and get that one out of the way. Corona, the Jackass theme song. That's a Minutemen song. That might be the most well-known work by the Minutemen. And while Black Flag was all over the top anger and aggression and angst and self-hatred and shit like that, the Minutemen were more interested in history and philosophy. Out of San Pedro, California, Mike Watt and Dee Boone were born of solidly working-class backgrounds. Their dads, they felt, kind of got a rough shake by the world, and it colored their perception of the world around them. They bucked the trend of punk kids yelling, "Fuck the government," which, you know, they agreed with, I agree with, we all probably agree with. They decided, though, that they needed to articulate why the government is bad in painstaking detail. And they also were different. They weren't interested in being hard or tough or mean or anything like that. They were, in their own words, corn dogs. Corn dogs who had a hard populist bent. You know, this quote here in the book really sticks with me. It says, "If you're working class, you don't start a band to just scrape by. You start a band to get rich." So art bands, with their inherently limited commercial prospects, were mainly the province of the affluent, which makes the Minutemen all the braver. They had no hope of commercial success. And yet they soldiered on through 12 records in 5 years, an amazing 75 songs in 1984 alone. They had their own way of making music that was entirely unique, and it came about without really knowing all the rules and kind of making it up as they went along. Mike Watt shared this little quote that kind of kills me. They didn't know bass guitars were different from regular ones, so Mike Watt put 4 strings on a regular guitar. He didn't even know it was supposed to be tuned lower. In fact, they didn't know anything about tuning at all. "We thought the tightness of the strings was like a personal thing, like, I like my strings loose. We didn't know what you had to do with pitch. It must have made your asshole pucker a mile away." truly delightful. But, you know, eventually they learned. They took cues from bands like Blue Oyster Cult and Black Sabbath, and they got the basics down. And then they started writing music their own way. And their first attempt at making music, they had a four-piece unit called, and this kind of kills me, The Reactionaries. I'm sure that that name is, you know, familiar to some folks out there. So, you know, Dee Boone and Mike Watt, they asked their friend Hurley to join them, and they got this cool guy to sing for them. You know, so they started hanging out at a punk show. They met a tall, intense-looking guy handing out flyers for a San Pedro gig by a band, his band, Black Flag. It was Greg Ginn, of course, and he invited the Reactionaries on the bill. It was their first show, and it was Black Flag's second show, and it immediately became a riot with all the kids fighting everybody. That band, the Reactionaries, only lasted a few months because Boone and Watt decided that having a frontman singer was too rock and roll and, quote, too bourgeoisie. So they brainstormed for a while. They picked the Minutemen because the name appealed to Dee Boone because, you know, not only the Revolutionary War Militia, but because it also had been used by a right-wing reactionary group from the 60s. So, you know, of course, fitting with his sense of history, his sense of populism, his sense of irony. And, you know, they kind of created their own language. The lyrics were essentially just rants by both of these guys that they dubbed spiels. You know, it's just what they say. And the other, you know, lingo they kind of threw in there was like bouge, short for bourgeoisie, which is bad. And Mersch, which meant commercial, which is, you know, also bad. And Econo, which meant thrifty or efficient. Their quote for everything is, "We jam Econo." And it was the way that they carried through. And I've always loved that line. That stuck with me, you know, for 15 years now since I first read this. So they put out Paranoid Time, a 7-song EP, their first release and the second ever release on Black Flag's SST label. It sold out its 300 pressings immediately. And so, you know, rather than trying to spend what little money they had to repress it, they decided, we're just going to make more music. We got more songs in us. Let's put out some more fucking music. So they did Punchline, another EP. This time it was 18 songs in 15 minutes. And they kind of formed their philosophy a little bit clearer. Dee Boone, he went to art school and he dropped out because he didn't want to use his art for commercial purposes. Watt, he studied electronics, but he never did it for a living because, you know, the only job he would think he would get with electronics was working in the defense industry, and he didn't want to do that. So punk rock was a way to kind of make their lives work for him and do something for their own and make a little bit of money. And, you know, their way of saying it was, you know, instead of getting angry or jealous about what somebody else has got, why not get artistic about it and create a little work site, a little fiefdom? As long as it doesn't oppress anybody or something, I think it's kind of healthy. Which, again, I really admire the philosophy with it. So they started getting played a bit on some local radio shows, and then a couple of stations around the country on college radio started playing them. So they decided to hit the road in Black Flag's terrible fucking van. And the road was a difficult experience for everyone. Watt says here, Dee Boone had to take a shit 20 minutes after we ate. I mean, to the minute. We'd be on the freeway and he'd be pull over and just he'd go right there. He didn't care. Dee Boone did not have shame. He was eating a lot of spirulina and shit like that, and the mule would be kicking down the door every time. He told me he had a theory how you knew if you were going to be an artist as a kid, you're either going to be packing it in or spreading it out. He said that determined, you know, how you dealt with your shit. He said, man, I smeared it all over the place, and I said, you still do. The friendship that these guys had is really incredible to me. But they toured incessantly after that on their own, not just with Black Flag, and they became legendary for relentless itineraries and their thrifty modus operandi. So they'd sleep at someone's house, they'd lug their own equipment, and, you know, maintain their own van. Everything was done econo. Despite that, they always turned a profit. So this is something that I didn't quite realize at the time, but they carried their own shit, they set up all their shit, they packed up all their shit immediately as soon as they were done playing. That was kind of an odd thing that people made fun of them for, not having a guy on your tour with you to help you carry shit. And it just, it seems like, of course, that makes sense. We are obviously living on a few bucks a day. Why would we pay somebody to carry our shit for us? We can do that. So doing all of these tours, you know, there was a music network opening up. You know, there were record stores that had independent labels. There were college towns with college radio. There were fanzines coming out. There was a railroad of venues assembling. And it was becoming a kind of a loose network of people that were navigating these waters. And, you know, of the scene, there's really only one rule, and that's that you had to play fast and loud. And you could kind of do anything else beyond that. That appears to be the theme of the book, because some bands, they get pretty wildly different here. The Minutemen are very different from Black Flag, but they played fast and loud, and that was good enough for the kids to seek them out and for them to make their mark. So they kind of dug a little bit deeper into these economic populist ideas. In between 82 and 84, D. Boone published a fanzine called The Prole. It lasted 6 issues, and he wrote politically oriented cartoons and articles and did record reviews. On some nights, they booked a local theater to, you know, let local underground bands play. And shows started early so that working people could get home at a reasonable hour, which is the best thing I've ever heard, and I think we need to get back to those days. The idea is that, you know, working men and women should have a culture in their life, music and art, and you don't have to necessarily live the rock and roll lifestyle shit where you have to stay up until 2 a.m. to see a band. Having a setup where it makes sense for the people that, you know, could engage with your art. So, aside from the Prole and the Union Theater they had set up, they had their own label. New Alliance was set up in 1980, and they did releases by themselves. They did compilations from local bands. They did a compilation with a Seattle New Wave band called Mr. Epp and the Calculations, notable because it featured Mudhoney singer Mark Arm, who we'll visit a little bit later. You know, when they were asked why they did that, why they started a label, you know, they just said, we were inspired by Black Flag. Part of being a punk band was that you also had to have a label. We never thought the label would get bigger. We just wanted to have it. So you saw the band, you could get the record. And, you know, New Alliance soon was paying for itself. One of the early New Alliance releases was a little record called Land Speed Record by Husker Du, who we will also get to a little bit later. You know, these two trios, they hit it off. They were on the same wavelength. They were, you know, perhaps a little bit more more of a thinking man's band. A little bit more tuneful. A little bit less fucking miserable all the goddamn time. And the Minutemen also, they did an EP on Reflex, which would be Husker Du's label. Another New Alliance release was, of course, Milo Goes to College by The Descendants. And again, they had an affinity with these guys. Billy and Frank were fishermen, Tony was a mailman, and Milo went to college. And everybody was just kind of on this same page. And it's really, really pretty inspiring. You know, the Minutemen got back in the studio. They did a full album's worth of recording in November of 83. But then Husker Du came into town and recorded their double album, Zen Arcade, in 3 days. And the Minutemen took it as a challenge. So they wrote and recorded 24 more songs within a month. And that's that healthy little competition there. So while Zen Arcade had, you know, a concept, you know, the Minutemen's album didn't necessarily, but it's still pretty fucking great. It was called Double Nickels on the Dime, and it sold 15,000 copies in its first year. it still sells pretty well, which is amazing. The title is Double Nickels on the Dime, incredibly clever. It's a poke at Sammy fucking Hagar, who had put out I Can't Drive 55, and they thought it was pretty funny. Like, you're such a wild guy, you'll break the speed limit. How about your tunes, though, buddy? We were, making fun of him a little bit. The title means 55 miles an hour on the button. We were Johnny Conservative. But nobody knew what the fuck we were talking about. We'd explain it to people and say, I don't get it. What's so funny about that? And we couldn't tell them that. Like, it was just our own kind of take on things, and it didn't make sense to anybody else. Well, they were also doing some things that, it didn't make any sense to anybody else in the punk scene. They made a music video, and it got nominated for an MTV award, which is outstanding because they spent $400 to put this thing together. Unfortunately, they lost out to a song by Kaja Gugu. So these guys, they were making it all happen. In 84, they had done an interview with someone in Georgia who they described as, quote, some long hair guy who had his own fanzine. And eventually they found out that guy was Michael Stipe of a band called R.E.M. R.E.M. was actually pretty popular by 84, so it's wild he didn't know who they were. So they took R.E.M., the bigger band there, they took the Minutemen out on the road with them, and they didn't really get the music so much, but they were on the same page, but it was different. They were playing folk music. They were more educated. They would soon be on a major label. But when they were playing on the road with R.E.M., they felt vindicated by their approach. Because R.E.M. had, they had professional tour crews, and Watt recalls those guys were assholes. They'd put a line of gaffing tape on the floor of the stage that said Geek Line, and we weren't allowed to cross. They'd switch our rooms out, they'd fuck with us constantly, and, after we played an entire set of Creedence songs on a show with them in Atlanta, the manager demanded that we get kicked off the bill. So as the band was getting better, as they were getting more well-known, they were ready to put out what they thought would be the best record they'd ever done, when unfortunately Dee Boone was killed in a tragic car accident. And it ended everything for this band, unfortunately. There's no way to carry that on with them, it broke up one of the last major indie bands who had and still carried the idealism of their childhood with them. And, the newer kids didn't have the same thing. It was just different. After a friend had called Big Black, frontman Steve Albini to break the news about Dee Boone dying, Albini wrote in his diary, "There's nobody left who's been doing it since the beginning, and nobody doing it all the way right. Fuck, it's like Buddy Holly or something. Sure, it's kind of pathetic to get all worked up over it, but man, they meant it, and that means something to me. What do we do now?" Watt is still touring in a town near you, surely soon. He seems like a great guy, and it's a shame that was the end for the Minutemen. Let's go ahead and take a detour to an entirely different part of the country from California. Let's talk about Husker Du. I wanted to end this episode with another piece of the SST puzzle. And this isn't the last we'll hear from SST, but this is one of the last essential pieces of that story. Now, Husker Du, out of every band covered in this book, they might be my favorite group of guys. The Replacements, they wrote my favorite songs out of all of these people, but they're definitely more conventional songs, and, well, the whole existence of the band was a fucking train wreck. Husker Du, on the other hand, you know, they're both wildly original with their music, and, well, it's also good to listen to. That's key. You know, Michael Azred's thoughts on this is that they were the key link between hardcore and the more melodic, accessible music that would eventually be termed college rock. They were the first band that SST signed that was not out of Southern California, and they became the star attraction of SST. They moved themselves and SST to another level by selling pretty significant units. And eventually they made the move to a major label. They were the first non-REM band to come from the underground scene in America to do that. And suddenly there was a kind of a commercial reality out of guys making underground music. You could eventually make it, as it's to say. So, you know, we start with Bob Mould, who in 78, he got a an underprivileged student scholarship at Malacaster College in St. Paul. He chose that school because it was known as kind of, you know, a left-wing type hippie place. But as soon as he got there, he realized that it was actually full of kids who called themselves Young Republicans. Love it. I also had that experience. He said, "I remember watching these kids getting up in the morning on my dorm floor, putting on a suit and tie and a briefcase, and talking about this guy from California named Ronald Reagan and how he's going to be the next president. And I'd be sitting there arguing with these fucks in speech class and poli-sci and just hating that, thinking, this is not acceptable behavior. This is not what we're supposed to be doing with our late teens." And that experience, it made him realize that we had to make our own system to live inside of that doesn't go along with this, because it's going to get ugly. Scary times are coming. I can tell because I can see kids on my floor wanting to grow up to exploit the lower class. Well, while he was there in Minnesota, he went to a punk record store. He met a fella named Grant Hart that was working as a clerk and playing cool punk music. And the two, you know, they became buddies. So, you know, one night, a little bit later, he was hanging out, Bob Mould was hanging out with Grant Hart with their friend Greg Norton and a keyboardist named Charlie Pine. At a little fucking bar band place. And so they decided right then and there that they were going to play a show, and they were going to play a show at this place. So they began, rehearsing together at Norton's mom's basement. And Bob, he was a dork with a leather jacket and a flying V, and he could play guitar really well. So they began playing covers together. And one night they started jamming on Psycho Killer by the Talking Heads. You know that part in the song where he's like, "Qu'est-ce que c'est?" And they've got all the French shit. So they decided to just start throwing all of the foreign phrases they could think of at each other. And at some point said, "Husker Du," which is the name of a popular 60s board game that's Norwegian for "Do you remember?" And the name stuck. They decided Husker Du was the name for them. So they played their first gig, and then they played another gig a week later. And the thing is that their keyboard player didn't know that the three other guys had secretly been practicing without him. So they played a second set that this guy wasn't aware of. And as they were playing the second set, Grant Hart's buddy Balls Mikkowski pulled the plug out of Pine's keyboard, pointed at Pine, gave him the finger, then pointed at the rest of the band and gave them a vigorous thumbs up. And with that, Husker Du was now and would forever be a three-piece. The name itself is fun. With a name like Husker Du, they hoped that meant they wouldn't be pigeonholed as a hardcore band. "It's not like Social Red Youth Dynasty Brigade Distortion," Bob Mould said. "When you see a name like that, you can pretty much guess that the band's been listening to music for a year, playing instruments for 6 months, been in a band for 2 months, and they wrote all the lyrics the night before the show. That's all well and good, I just don't want to be lumped in with them." So, they started playing a little bit around the Midwest, and in March 1980, they arranged to play a Chicago show the same night as Black Flag was playing, and they called it a Black Flag after party. And sure enough, they convinced Black Flag to show up to the club that they were playing at. Mold said, "We were on fire. We were way too jacked up on everything, amphetamines in particular. I was bouncing from wall to wall, throwing myself off the walls. I had this hammer and I was smashing stuff. We were going nuts. We were on a mission to impress the hell out of Black Flag." At the end of the set, they started fucking up the venue, throwing blue paint all over the place. The waitress is pissed off at him, tries to get him kicked out, and Black Flag looks on him in astonishment, and they were scared to come up to them. They were just like, "What are you guys?" And Bob Mold told them, "We're like, we're Husker Du. Who the hell are you?" So it was a solid relationship from the start. There was a new label in town called Twin Tone that we'll get to a little bit later. They had expressed some interest in the band, but they pulled out because one of the co-owners decided instead to sign The Replacements, a young, snotty Minneapolis band who had played only one or two gigs, weren't really known, and Husker Du had already had a modest regional following. So they were a little bit resentful of that. And they decided to create their own record label instead. "Fuck you guys, we'll make our own." They called it Reflex because it was a reflex against Twin Tone. They put out a little 7-inch single, and it did pretty well. It got them some write-ups, and people were interested. But, you know, they were interested in, you know, maybe pushing things a little bit further there. When they first started, I don't think there was a faster band alive. Their first record, appropriately named Land Speed Record, was recorded for the princely sum of $350 in 1982, and it might have been the fastest thing around until, I don't know, like, fucking Power Violence or Grindcore was invented a little bit later. So, the thing is, they didn't have any money to put this fucking thing out. They were all pretty much broke, working shitty jobs, and they decided to call up SST. See if they would do it. And, SST said, you know, they had some money, they put it out, and they tipped off Mike Watt that Husker Du was looking for a label, and Watt offered to release the record on the Minutemen's label, New Alliance. So they sent him a tape, and the album sold out of its initial pressing of 1,000 copies in about 3 days. So Husker Du is, they're writing, they're releasing EPs, they're touring constantly. In December of 82, they took off on a 5-week tour. It took them through the Midwest, Southwest, and through California. And in California, they were going to record and mix their next album with Spot, the SST in-house producer, in a single day. You know, trying to make a whole album in a single day is pretty hard, but it became impossible because the power got cut off to the studio because they hadn't paid the fucking electric bill. So that album ended up being a 7-song EP called Metal Circus. And this Metal Circus is also fast as shit, but the thing is, it sounds like a million times better, both in terms of like the recording quality and the songs themselves. Things suddenly got way more melodic and, in one man's opinion, way more fucking sick. And with it, they were kind of turning away from the overtly political tracks of Land Speed Record, and they turned their attention to everything else. And it was a turning point for the band because Husker Du was a phenom with, you know, the skinheaded hardcore kids around the world, but this had tracks that were getting picked up by college radio, and in turn, you know, also picked up by kids who didn't necessarily have Black Flag tattoos. And this this was a pretty big change for the band. Interviewed about it, their bass player, Greg Norton, just said, you know, "I don't tend to walk down the street whistling hardcore." they wanted to have some hooks there. So they're touring on this thing, and they had a fairly notable experience at their first New York City show, and I'd like to share this little thing with you. They didn't have a very good turnout for it, but, you know, they did a great show regardless. The second billed band on this show was The Replacements, and they only got paid $100, which was less than the opening band, who Norton described as, quote, "a pretty shitty punk band." They were called The Young and the Useless. And Norton had complained that the replacements were getting the shaft on this, but the guy who booked it was like, yeah, well, you know, your friends from Minneapolis are just lucky to be on the bill. You know, Greg Norton thought it sucked so bad they should pay me $100. Well, Young and Useless later evolved into a band called the Beastie Boys, and they continued to get at least $100 per show for the rest of their careers. Like all great songwriting partnerships, there was a tremendous amount of tension between Hart and Mould. See, Grant was kind of a hippie, and Bob Mould was more of a, he had more of a German serial killer vibe. So Grant Hart would write 20 songs, and then Bob would write 21 songs and, you know, demand the next album contain at least 65% Bob songs. So as you can imagine, that led to some fairly acrimonious moments with the band throughout history. King Coffee, who we'll get to a little bit later as well when we get to the Butthole Surfers, wrote Husker Du, their first out-of-state fan letter, and he roadied for them on a Texas tour in the 80s. He said, you know, there was definitely an intense dynamic between the three of them. There didn't seem to be much humor involved with how they approached their music, but as guys, they were cool. They'd hang out. They just took what they were doing awful seriously. Which I guess is like what you should do if you're trying to make this a career. I don't know. I still don't understand any of this. There was, you know, the band, they didn't care about this at all. But I would say that this also kind of broke some barriers in another way. That in the 80s, you know, in the mid 80s, there were rumors that someone in the band might be gay. And everybody thought it would be Norton because he had a handlebar mustache. but no, it was actually both Grant Hart and Bob Mould. Both gay men that had, you know, lovers that they would bring on the road with them. And, you know, they just, it was kind of an open secret, but nobody seemed to care, which is very surprising, considering I think everything that I had ever heard about how punks were in the 80s. So I don't know. I think there's just something really, really kind of neat about that personally. All right. So let's get back to 1983. At this point, the Replacements and Soul Asylum and some guy who called himself Prince, they were all in Minneapolis, and it was suddenly a pretty hip place to be. You know, so Bob Mould and Grant Hart, they're writing their dicks off, and they have so many tracks, they decide to put out an extremely cool, uncool record for a hardcore band, cool record for, you know, rock and roll guys. They wanted to do a double concept album, and they called it Zen Arcade. And it was so good that it caused problems. See, SST, like, they erred on the side of caution, and they did an initial pressing of somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 copies. And that sold out in about 2 weeks. So the band's on tour to promote it, and they don't have any fucking records to sell. And that was the beginning of them knowing that things were maybe askew with SST. They were out promoting a record that they couldn't sell to anybody. So when SST realized that this was going to be a big seller, they had to be cautious about their expenditures because Black Flag had like four albums they were going to release that year. The Minutemen was going to make their next one a double album as well. So even though SST had some cash, you know, their resources were pretty much nil. So trying to press more than 5,000 copies of something was not anything SST had ever done before, and nobody knew how many they'd need to sell, because if they printed too many, they'd have to eat the costs. And, you know, these guys are already in trash to begin with. What the fuck are you going to do? So Husker Du did SST a solid, all right? They deferred taking royalties for this big-ass record so that the label could stay solvent and they could have, you know, their albums out there for people to buy. Norton says, "We were being real nice guys, which might not have been a good thing in hindsight." So, you know, they made most of their money touring. They didn't think that this would be a big deal, but by 1987, SST still owed Husker Du something like $200,000, which the label is still paying off years later. Probably still hasn't paid off. Husker Du didn't even have a contract with SST until the very end of their association with the label. Grant Hart said, with a sigh, "It was all based on peace, love, and anarchy." Huge mistake. Huge mistake. So they're starting to get their fill of SST. Number one is they don't want to work with Spot. which is what they had to do. But they didn't have a choice to work with him. SST made him work with them. So they wanted to self-produce the next record, New Day Rising, but SST wouldn't let him do it. So they flew Spot out to them in Minneapolis while they're recording. And the first thing he did when he showed up there was go to the recording console and demand that the entire thing just gets moved 2 inches to the left, just to, you know, wave his dick around. Regardless of this, and regardless of my opinions on, you know, the efforts of Spot's producing, New Day Rising was a big hit, and every music journalist in America, you know, listened to these tunes and was like, oh, fuck, these guys are great, they're gonna go to a major label. There was a lot of speculation around this, and, you know, the band wanted to take it to the next level. They wanted to be able to sell as many records as people wanted to buy. And, you know, SST, you know, tried to help them play ball a little bit, tried to get them played on college radio and shit, but, you know, there was some reluctance on their part because the primary focus of SST was Black Flag. And, you know, also there was some tensions because the guys in Black Flag thought Husker Du might be a little soft because they did things like stay in motels and occasionally write a happy song. and that didn't really go with their vibe. But, you know, after this point, Husker Du is the biggest selling band on SST by a huge margin. And finally, the band has the freedom to kick Spot out of the recording studio and make their own fucking record. And the result was Flip Your Wig. And up to that point, it's definitely the best sounding Husker Du album. So the band was touring constantly and usually selling out, but their audience was growing incrementally, not by leaps and bounds. The band felt that they had hit a sales ceiling that only a major label could break through. And there were outside forces as well. One of the biggest indie distributors at the time, Jim, had gone bankrupt in 1985. And when that happened, you know, it changed everything. It wasn't many months ever after that that everybody had to go major, because when Jim couldn't pay on the indie stuff, a lot of the indie labels just went belly up. 4 months after Flip Your Wig dropped, the band started recording Candy Apple Gray. And they got picked up by Warner Brothers. That's the time that they decided to make the leap. They couldn't stick around with this shit. They needed to make sure that their records could be purchased. Warner Brothers is a little bit pissed that they got Candy Apple Gray and not Flip Your Wig, but, you know, you get what you get. The band demanded that they, you know, basically have somebody to run their office. They had to have a proper manager. So Bob Mould, he got his friend Dave Savoy to run it. And, you know, he was 24 years old. He just got thrust into mediating between a major label and a bunch of guys that are starting to really hate each other. And in 87, on the eve of their first tour, you know, Savoy, you know, he jumps off a Minneapolis bridge to his death. And, you know, that kind of ended things for the band in a way that nothing else could. So Mould decided he was going to be the band's manager. He was going to call the shots with the label, and he was making some really, really big mistakes. At this point, Grant Hart is starting to do a shit ton of heroin, and Mould decided simultaneously to quit drinking and doing speed, which the guy had been doing constantly. And it could not have made life more miserable for everybody in the band. So the competition over which guy's songs would end up on which record ended up resulting in another double album. This was Warehouse Songs and Stories. And because Mould was managing and he wasn't doing so great at this, Warner wasn't really willing to play ball on it like SST was. Husker Du was going to get paid for this for a single album instead of a double album, and they were going to eat the cost of production for the double album. It came out, it sold 125,000 units, which is, you know, the target that Warner had set for them, but not a bit more. And with all the promotional expenses, they didn't make any more money than they would have done with SST. The entire thing, going to a major label, being the first to do it, didn't really pan out for them, and with these guys slowly losing their minds being around each other, decided soon after to call it quits. And it is a shame. Grant Hart went on to make, I think, 2 solo records. Bob Mould made a shit ton of solo records, both under his name and as Sugar. And those are all actually pretty good, if you're into that kind of thing. It's definitely more pop-oriented than anything Husker Du is doing, but still sounds great. Grant, you know, had a tough time after the dissolution of Husker Du. And in 2017, he died of liver cancer. He was 56 years old. Grant and Bob never quite made up. They for the rest of their lives, continued to kind of chirp back and forth each other after this terribly acrimonious breakup. And it's a sad end to a tale that was initially so full of promise. I'm going to be totally honest with you guys. I had no idea that I would be here recording now for 1 hour and 5 minutes and just get this far into it. So I think that we ought to do is call it here. Let's meet back again for another episode where we talk about some things like, I don't know, how about Dinosaur Jr., Big Black, The Butthole Surfers. You know, maybe we could do Fugazi, you know, if you're good. So we'll reach back on that one. In the meantime, I'm going to go drink some water.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.